Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So just a little bit of local news. You guys rock, okay? That's the news. You rock. In Santa Cruz, the health officer told me yesterday that we are looking at a continued drop in our doubling time. Our doubling time is now slightly above 10 days. And when you look at doubling times across all of the counties in California, we are definitely in the bottom third. There are a few that are doing better than us. The only one named on this graph is Napa. But like I said, you guys rock, and I'm very proud of you. People are cheating a little bit. Okay, let's not be Pollyanna about this. You know who you are. But enough people aren't. Enough people have gotten the memo and actually believe in science and the germ theory of disease. And that's just great. So we're up to 108 cases. By the way, just for perspective, the worst county in the state right now is LA with a doubling time of about 4 days. So, you know, half of ours, and that's not very good. Interesting study came out. This from a New York maternity ward, just a survey. They tested 215 women as they came in labor. 85% were negative. Of 2% were positive with some symptoms, and 13% were positive without symptoms. So even more data about all of these asymptomatic cases out there previously spreading virus, because, hey, I felt fine. Now, due to the universal masking orders, spreading a lot less. So we're going to anticipate that that curve's going to flatten out. As we talked about last week, and if you missed that show, you can go to AskDrDawn.com and look at it, rather listen to it. But we're going to have some interesting challenges. We're going to be skipping stones instead of riding the tsunami. I'll take the skipping stones. But as the health officer of Santa Cruz County said yesterday morning, I'm not expecting a wave. I'm expecting a bunch of ripples. How we do that? How electronics plays into it. It's going to be an interesting time, maybe a bumpy night. Got a lot of questions this week about drugs, ACE inhibitors and ARBs specifically. And it's been murky, but it's starting to clarify. If anything, these drugs, which are known to upregulate ACE2, might be an actually very good thing. It turns out that the ACE2, which is the thing that the spike protein on the virus hooks onto, is actually immunologically active. It produces a whole bunch of compounds, angiotensin 1 through 7. And I recently saw research, well, actually it's old research, being kind of dug out and rebroadcast to people. But there's a receptor for angiotensin A1 on T cells, and this receptor blunts the pro-inflammatory response of the macrophages. And so it's a dance between the natural killer cells and the macrophages, but the absence of that blunting may have something to do with that sort of late flare of the disease, which is turning to be kind of phenomenologically something really interesting. People start to recover and then they get a whole lot worse all of a sudden. That may be because they're running out of ACE2. So having high levels of ACE2 may actually help you being inflamed. And of course, every diabetic on the planet is supposed to be on one of these drugs to protect their kidneys. So certainly that group would be disadvantaged in the extreme. And France, vive la France, the home of far-fetched hypotheses, has done it again. We had the hydroxychloroquine, and now we have the nicotine. And I just finished reviewing an article. You can read it yourself if you want. It's at a open access journal called Keios, Q-E-I-O-S. And if you just search on nicotine and COVID, you'll find an article going into, oh my God, deep, deep biochemical woods, essentially suggesting that maybe nicotine might help. And they cite some very thin epidemiological support for this, very thin. I won't go into detail. And then they cite a lot of very interesting known mechanisms to back up the hypothesis. So what we need here is to walk through how science works. It generally starts with epidemiology. We notice that left-handed blondes are more likely to succeed in volleyball. And then is there perhaps a gene for volleyball that's close to a gene for left-handedness? And then that's called hypothesis generation. And so you observe something and then you think of reasons why it might be true, reasons that you can test. And in the case of a postulate that nicotine might be protective, because one study in China said that there were fewer smokers in the group that did well, or excuse me, the group that did well had more smokers, or something like that. There were fewer smokers in the people who ended up hospitalized. This is the sort of thing that can absolutely be due to chance. Epidemiology is often due to chance. And that's the thing. It's only good for hypothesis generation. It's not good for drawing conclusions, even if they're logical, even if, as in this study, you can find a good plausible mechanism. You need the plausible mechanism, but then you need actual data. Usually we start out with cell culture, but in the case of something like this, I think we're going to move straight to humans, particularly since nicotine is available over-the-counter most places and therefore is not really a controlled substance. I do think that there's some plausibility here, and that should get you funding for a prospective trial. Unfortunately, there are plenty of people rolling into the hospital with COVID, plenty of non-smokers, so you'd take non-smokers and slap a nicotine patch on some of them, and you'd need, 1,000 maybe, to be statistically powerful enough to draw conclusions, 500 of each flavor. That's how you do science, and you do that, and it's like, oh, that looks favorable, let's try it at a different hospital. You get it replicated 2 or 3 times. Then you kind of step back and say, well, how dangerous is this? How widely available? Should we roll with this as a best practice recommendation? And then a whole bunch of people in business suits and ties, not, I might add, white coats, sit around and discuss the various implications, make a decision, and outcome the guidelines. It's at this stage that big industry and corporate interests get involved, and involved they are. So pure science is a lovely concept, but I haven't seen it, and I don't know that I ever will. Let me take a deep breath, and we're going to move to being just a little bit philosophical. You've probably heard of this hammer in the dance concept, and the idea is, in a perfect world where we actually had lots of tests and they were readily available, we would loosen up the shelter in place, and we'd start opening up restaurants or theaters, doors, you know, other things that are currently shut down, the non-essential things. And we'd test random sample of the population, maybe test the people who are in the stores, and we'd see if the rate of positives started to go up. And if it did, then we'd bring down the hammer and shut things back down again. And what everyone is now anticipating is that you're going to get, it's going to be whack-a-mole, and it's going to be whack-a-mole for a couple of years. So how do we spot the mole quickly and whack it hard and then keep letting the other holes be open, whack their hole when, in fact, it's necessary to do so? And how do we track this? And how do we manage the early ascertainment? We so need testing. Let's not do blame here, all right? Let's do reality. We, the people of the United States, screwed up royally. And don't tell me you had nothing to do with it, okay? Because we all had something to do with it. We live here. We take advantage of what this society gives us, which means we also have responsibility for where it screws up. And it screwed up big time here, and there's just no whitewashing that. But I think that you have to also step back a little bit and think about what it is about the planet that made this inevitable. There was a conference after Ebola, a health conference. Bill Gates, already retired at that point, gave a speech saying that the most immediate peril for humanity wasn't nuclear war, it was an epidemic. And he basically had looked at Ebola and said, you know, if something more contagious than this gets rolling, we are in severe trouble. And he actually laid out in his speech all the stuff we don't have, like preventative measures, that is to say, PPE, adequate hospital equipment in excess of baseline demand. And it really doesn't matter where this virus came from, because sooner or later something was going to emerge. If somebody screwed up at a lab, or if something jumped in a garden from a bat to a pangolin, does it matter, really? What it matters is that we weren't prepared to deal with it, and it wasn't dealt with well from the get-go, and it's continued until it wasn't taken seriously, and it wasn't appreciated, and people were slow. Some slower than others, but many, many people died as a result of not recognizing what this could look at and not having the backup systems in place. Now, that second error, I don't expect it to happen again. But we've got a civilization that's organized along lines that set us up for this. Not just the rapid travel, but the supply chain, the fact that things are shipped all over the world, the fact that it's the just-in-time inventory rather than having warehouses stocked with stuffs. We've also got a science that is balkanized. The scientists in different disciplines don't communicate with each other. They're all locked into their separate journals. Journals, I might add, that now are behind paywalls that keep anybody who isn't in an academic setting from even seeing them, because it's like, oh, you want to read the article? Ante up $35. Well, folks, I'm sorry. I have to stick with the abstract or get one of my friends who has an academic connection to pull the article for me. We are also compartmentalized and we're in the era of communication, but the people who should be communicating aren't. And we need to really do some serious self-criticism as a world culture, which is what we are, apparently, because we all got the same disease and got it quick. We need to figure out how we can do better next time, because we are going to get through this and there will be a next time. And I hope this sees a reorganization, number one, of the American hospital system and its system for reimbursement, because the idea that somebody with COVID is afraid to go to the hospital because they're afraid of the bill for testing. Well, do I need to say anything? I don't think so. Let's go to our first email. This one from Roseanne, and Roseanne in New Jersey. So Zan writes, basal cell. Hello, doctor. I have basal cell carcinoma on my left nostril. I'll need Mohs and plastic surgery. I also have squamous in situ on my forehead. I've done the Effudex thing. Presumably it didn't work. Just reading on some health alternative sites about using liquid iodine 10 to 12 times a day, alternating with a baking soda paste. Also, on Holistic Cancer Living, read about CBD oil and skin cancer. And I know everything on the internet is 100% accurate, so I would like, or maybe she meant is not 100% accurate. So I would like your opinion on these. Or maybe she was being sarcastic. I always enjoy your analogies, learn so much more that way. So Roseanne, I appreciate that the idea of having somebody take the equivalent of a microtome to your face is less than palatable. And the location is cosmetically difficult. So I agree that you probably do need Mohs surgery. For the audience, Mohs surgery is really quite time and energy intensive for the doctors involved, because you've got a pathologist and you've got a doctor, and the doctor slices off a slice of skin, hands it to the pathologist, who stains it, looks at it, and says, nope, there's still cancer right there at 4 o'clock. And the doctor goes, okay, takes another slice at that area, and eventually carves away the cancer, and there's a good margin on all of the tissue lines. This is often done for basal cell because basal cell is like a dandelion. It has a deep tap root, like all of those lovely tenacious weeds I'm yanking out of my garden before the soil gets too dry. And if you break off the root, just like a dandelion, it'll grow back. So with the basal cell, it dives deep, and you want to get it as quickly as you can because it tends to be deeper than it is wide. And they will go all the way down across into bones. So they're nasty, but they take a long time. Probably the closest thing really is leprosy, really, in terms of its speed and its potential to disfigure. So you don't want to mess with these. And I'm sorry that the Effudex didn't work. There are some other treatments that you might look at. Not on your nostril. The fulguration was an old technique. It basically was a destructive process. And injections with alpha interferon was being done for a while, and I think it got pushed aside by the Mohs surgery, but it was done in cosmetically sensitive areas. And I don't know if there's anyone still doing that, but it's that drug's still available, so you might see if you could try that before going to the Mohs. Now, liquid iodine, show me your data. I did a Google Scholar search on that, and there's no evidence whatsoever that that's going to cure your basal cell. Iodine, I think it's an extrapolation from the fact that iodine is an anti-mitotic agent, and I tend to prescribe a lot of iodine to my women of a certain age, particularly if they have breast tenderness. There are studies going back to the 60s. I found one in the 70s that really intrigued me, but I could never get the dose from the author, so I didn't incorporate it till much later in my practice. But I always remembered trying to hunt for, okay, what did you do? Because that sounded really interesting. Iodine's an anti-proliferative agent, so it might slow down the growth of breast cancer cells or prevent the breast cancer cells from migrating into cancer, from pre-cancer into cancer, that is. It is interesting that the breast next to the thyroid has the most iodine receptors in the body, and so it's clearly serving some kind of purpose. And I don't think you can say, well, if it works in the breast, it's going to work in a basal cell. The squamous cell could also potentially respond to it could also respond a little bit to the interferon, and that might be something to talk with a alternative or at least a alternative-leaning dermatologist if you don't want to have surgery. Now, I had a practice in the San Lorenzo Valley, and so a lot of people were making this stuff called Rick Simpson oil, which is a very concentrated marijuana oil with a high, high level of THC. And I definitely heard multiple anecdotal stories about, yeah, I had this thing on my skin, and I got me some Rick Simpson oil, and the cancer went away. I will emphasize that has absolutely nothing in the medical literature for obvious reasons. It's only been legalized a little while, so there's just no opportunity for this to have been studied. What literature I could find was looking at different cancers, not skin cancers. There was a interesting study in rodents that showed that concentrated THC was radiosensitizing. And so that was just one study. I didn't see anything else that was persuasive. And there was an anecdotal case study of some poor child with cancer who took an individualized THC treatment and died anyway. But, you know, she died of something that wasn't related to a complication of the THC. So, you know, you can't really judge any of that in terms of anything resembling the merits. I think if it's a pre-squamous cell, if it's in situ, and you wanted to try the CBD, you'd have to get some, and you'd have to be very religious about applying it. And like I said, it's just anecdotal, and I don't really recommend you do that. I think you should go forward with your surgery, because that is a proven thing. Depending on how high it is on your forehead, you might just use a destructive process. But most people nowadays in this era would tend to go straight to a surgery. Our next email comes from an anonymous emailer in Palo Alto. Subject, night eating. Hi, Dr. Don. I've recently started waking up one or more times per night hungry and unable to fall back asleep until I eat. Nothing has changed in my daytime diet or activity level that I can identify. What are some strategies to help stop this habit? Well, there's a couple of hormone possibilities. And I looked up sleep eating disorder, and there are actually two. There's a kind of sleep-related eating disorder, it's called, which is basically sleep walking to the refrigerator and eating. They're not awake, and they sleep eat. And then the other one is called nocturnal eating disorder, and that sounded really just like what you have. They wake up with an uncontrollable urge to eat in the middle of the night, no matter how hungry they are or aren't, and many can't fall back asleep until they eat and put something in their stomach. And the first thing you do with this is before you, it's like 1-3% of the general population has this diagnosis, so you're not alone. And a lot of times it's related to an underlying medical problem. So stomach ulcers, oddly enough, but I guess that makes sense because there's no food going in, and so you wake up in pain, but you don't interpret it as pain, you interpret it as hunger. Sleep apnea, depression, other eating disorders, and a traumatic event apparently can do that. You didn't mention whether there had been a traumatic event, but I can think of one. It's called lockdown. So if the timing fits with that, and it's a lockdown-related event, there's a couple of possibilities. Let's go hormones next, because what we think is going on, it could be a low blood sugar. And if you're eating a lot of starch at night, like, you know, you have changed your diet, no, you didn't want to put it in the email, or maybe you've always eaten a lot of carbs, but now you're eating just that much more, or it's finally caught up with you. So I would urge you to get a blood test called a hemoglobin A1C and a fasting morning insulin, just to make sure this isn't early diabetes manifesting as an eating disorder. But the other hormone that could be involved here is ghrelin, the hunger hormone. And this is a thing. When you fill your stomach, your ghrelin levels drop about 5 or 6 hours after you've eaten. They start to rise again. That's supposed to be blunted overnight. But if you've lost that blunting, you may be suffering from a ghrelin attack. And it's typically treated by circadian rhythm entrainment. And this is where I was thinking maybe the shutdown could be a factor, because while your activity level may have changed, where you're doing your activity may have changed, and you may be suffering from a circadian rhythm disorder. So I bet your habits really have changed. And my recommendation is for the next couple of weeks, start getting early morning light, like outside kind of light, and maybe 20 to 30 minutes of outside light, early morning light. And then in the evenings, get some blue blocker glasses. I don't think that the blue blockers on the screens, you know, in the computers or in the phone can possibly work as well as you need them to. They can change the tint, but you're still getting light of the frequency that can turn off melatonin and perpetuate the whole dysregulation of ghrelin release. So put on some amber glasses after 7 p.m. There's one study that supports this as an effective therapy. Obviously, it would not be a placebo trial. That would be very hard to do. But early morning light and blue blocker glasses after 7 p.m. was published in the Journal of Biological Rhythms. And I'm going to spell the author's name in case you want to look it up. Goal Stunkard. Boy, no, let's hope he's in Scandinavia, where that probably doesn't sound as bad as it sounds to our ears. Goel, last name Stunkard. And if you can't be bothered with the light therapy and getting up in the morning, you could try a drug. Topamax is the drug of choice for treating the nocturnal eating disorder. And it is a mild appetite suppressant, so it's taken at night. It's also moderately sedating, so your brain doesn't feel as hungry, and it drowses you out a little bit, so you're less likely to wake up in the first place. It's a typical pharmacological patch, rather than going upstream to find the source of, it's like, oh, shall we see whose cows are fouling our river water, or shall we just boil the river water so we can drink it? There you have, in a nutshell, the difference between functional medicine and conventional medicine. Boil the water, people, versus let's go find those cows and get them backed off from the pasture. Ah, there you go. A colorful metaphor. I'm going to a story that I was sort of saving for when I didn't have enough emails, which is just now. A couple of weeks ago, someone asked a question about body temperature. And I thought, you know, I'm going to research that a little bit. And this is what I learned. That 98.6 number that we all have in our heads, that actually dates back to 1851. And it was a German physician named Karl Reinhold August Wunderlich. You got to love that name. He said, taking millions of temperature readings from 25,000 patients in Leipzig, and he announced that their average was the equivalent in Celsius of 98.6. That would be 37. He defined that as normal, but more recent studies have shown that it's closer to 97.88. And let's be clear here. I went to the sheriff's office the other day to turn in some medications, and they scanned me with a little infrared thing, and I have those in my office too. If we compare those to, say, an oral temperature, they are stunningly inaccurate, plus or minus 2 degrees at any given moment, because of things like, wind chill and ambient temperature. So typically what people do is they check themselves and then they check the other person. And of course, most physicians are now checking their oral temperature daily, if not twice daily, so we can take ourselves offline should we develop a fever. But the other thing to understand is that when you do that and compare it with the infrared, it's kind of like the tear of the thermometer. You have to figure out what the ambient shift is and then compare. But people really do fall within, you know, a degree or so. So if you're getting up into the 100, you're definitely febrile, 100 oral. And of course, like I said, there's a fudge factor. If the wind is blowing, you might have 100 oral and a 98 with the infrared. But it's a good screening tool. There are better cameras that actually digitally compare the temperature of the individual with the temperature of the other individuals in the area. And so it sort of averages it out and looks for the outlier. And when you see those infrared cameras of people coming in via airports, I remember first seeing that during the SARS era, that's what that is. We argued, there were people who said, you know, the temperature seems to have dropped. Why would that be? Well, has it really dropped? And so that generated some scientific papers for a while. But then in 2018, the National Archive of Computerized Data on Aging in the United States released the medical records, can you imagine, of all of the veterans of the Union Army taken from 1862 until 1940, over 83,900 temperature readings. So you've got to love numbers to analyze that data, because it was clearly written down. But they found that the average body temperature has steadily decreased by about 0.02 of a degree Celsius per decade. Veterans born more recently were born cooler, which is super interesting. Overall, the average temperature of men born between 1800 and 1997 decreased 0.03 degrees per birth decade, and women had about the same loss, but we don't have as robust a number of data points for women. And in a paper study published this January in a journal I've never heard of called eLife, a Journal of Biology and Medicine, the author of this paper, Dr. Parsonnet, says that it's probably just that people aren't sicker. Because remember, if you average 83,000 temperature readings, some of those people are going to be fighting off an illness. Some of them are going to have, back then, tuberculosis or untreated syphilis. In fact, the advent of antibiotics for strep throat virtually wiped out syphilis kind of accidentally. Otherwise, people were walking around with latent syphilis, and that raised the average temperature of the population. At least that's the hypothesis. But, you know, you have to wonder, are there other variables going on? Most of us now live in temperature-controlled homes. Well, not me, but that's another in conversation. And temperature does seem to make a difference. We're segue over to chemotherapy. There's a lot of data that cancers don't like temperatures. If you give rats cancer or mice, I guess this was lab mice, and heat up the room they're in, the cancers don't do as well. And you don't kill the mice. Other people are working on heating tumor cells. There are certain abdominal cancers, and this is the standard of medical care. They're treated with hot chemotherapy, in which the drug is heated to 103 degrees, which changes how much of it is absorbed by the cancer cell, which sort of makes sense. But we also have to deal with the fact that a cooler body temperature has been associated with longevity. A lower metabolic rate and a lower temperature have been linked with longer lifespan in these studies looking at calorie restriction. There's a lot of confounds there. I love kind of walking through these things and just pointing out as we walk by, oh, wait, there's a little lesson about how science works, because there's alternative explanations, right? Here's a correlation between low body temperature and longevity, but it's related to decreased calorie intake and so a reduced metabolism. But they're also eating less, right? That's the whole point of the reduced calories. So they have less inflammation because food is inherently inflammatory. So if you eat less of it, you'll be less inflamed, and that may have an aging effect. And in another research area looking at the temperature of muscles, there's a Dr. Craig Heller, a biology professor at Stanford. And he has shown that muscle fatigue, as we experience it, is actually caused by heat. And they are postulating that there is a temperature-sensitive enzyme that gets triggered as a safety valve, forcing the production of chemicals that power muscle contraction, stopping that production. And they've proved it using our favorite lab animal, undergraduates, by inventing some special gloves that chill blood as they move through the hands. So the muscles in the arms get cooled by these cooling gloves. And the researchers brags, I've had freshmen doing more than 800 push-ups using the cooling gloves, which definitely sounds like a statistically significant effect. So maybe what we all need to do is monitor our temperature and figure out the baseline right now. And this is the advice I'm giving. Know what your temp is supposed to be by averaging out. You may be one of those people who has a higher temp in the middle of the day and a lower temp at night. If you are, then you need to factor that in. And I have always believed my patients when they tell me, oh, I'm normally 97 and I'm checking them and they're 99. I believe their data, but I think the better you can make your data, the more likely you are to pick up something early. And right now, if you feel sick and you don't have a fever, well, you're probably sick. So don't let the absence of a temperature drive you to make a mistake. We know there's a lot of variability out there. Well, we've got a few minutes left, and so I want to give you a little present, a truly bizarre news of the weird. This is a man in North Carolina, and he took some antibiotics back in 2011, and after that he became depressed. He suffered memory loss, and then once he was driving at night and he hadn't drunk a drop of alcohol, but he was pulled over by the police and he was found to have a blood alcohol 2.5 times the legal limit, which is basically a 0.2, which is huge. But officer, I haven't had anything to drink. Yes, sir, a likely story. But later on, researchers actually concluded that he had something called auto brewery syndrome. And that's not where there's a brewery in the auto factory, although some or the automobile dealership, although someone should consider that because, you know, there's a brew pub everywhere practically. Why not the car dealership? But auto brewery syndrome is actually happening inside the gut. Certain fungi take root, and they are capable of converting carbohydrates from food into alcohol. And it can occur in healthy people, and they look like they're alcoholic. The smell, the breath, the gait changes. But the auto brewery syndrome can be treated with oral antifungals. And sure enough, after a course of antifungals, our gentleman in North Carolina is cured. And we're all happy to hear that, but I am fascinated by the concept of the auto brewery syndrome. One last little news of the weird. German scientists say they've identified a bacterium that feeds on polyurethane. It's a species of Pseudomonas, and it's the only known organism capable of eating the plastic that's used in diapers, sneakers, and foam insulation, which would be great. They found it, by the way, in a landfill. As polyurethane breaks down, it releases a toxic chemical that kills off most bacteria, but not Pseudomonas. Pseudomonas, by the way, is a very nasty bug when it gets into your lungs, very certain species anyway. It's very tenacious. And it is also, certain species also have found a way to live in the human microbiome. So the ubiquity and inventiveness of bacteria, the first real form of life on the planet and the one with the most experience in dealing with change, never ceases to amaze me. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.